The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here to, you know, cut through the noise around big ideas and give you that solid conceptual map you need.
Yeah, to feel like you can actually participate in the conversations shaping our world.
Exactly. And today, we're tackling a really big one, machine learning. We're diving deep into Ethan L. Payton's, well, his foundational guide.
And this isn't just tech talk. I mean, machine learning isn't stuck in labs anymore, right? It's everywhere. It's behind your search results, how traffic flows, even potentially medical diagnoses.
Right. So our mission today, for you listening, is pretty straightforward. Take L. Payton's really quite rigorous thinking and translate it. Make it a clear framework.
So you don't just get what ML does, but you start to get a feel for how it kind of, well, thinks.
Okay, so let's start where L. Payton does, with the core puzzle. If we're so good at writing software, why do we suddenly need machines to learn stuff on their own?
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't old school programming handle things like, say, spotting deepfakes or filtering really sophisticated spam?
Well, it really boils down to complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And rigidity. Traditional programming means a human has to literally write down every single rule.
Mm.
If this exact thing happens, then do that specific thing.
Yep.
And that whole approach just falls apart when things get messy, when the world changes constantly, or the input isn't perfectly clear.
Like trying to build a spam filter with fixed rules. You say, okay, block emails with these keywords, and the spammers just change the spelling slightly, or they hide the text in an image.
Instantly obsolete, exactly. Your human-written rules just can't keep up.
Or think about something like recognizing a face, trying to write code to define exactly what a face is, accounting for every possible angle, lighting, beard, glasses, expression.
Forget it. It's basically an impossible task for a human programmer to list all those rules explicitly.
So the big idea here, the core argument L. Payton makes, is that machine learning isn't just nice to have, it's necessary. It lets systems learn from examples, adapt to that complexity we just can't pin down with fixed rules.
And we're learning from a real authority here, Ethan L. Payton. He's not just a professor at Boise University. He literally wrote the book, the standard, very rigorous textbook, Introduction to Machine Learning.
Ah, okay. So he's really one of the architects of the field, intellectually speaking.
Absolutely. And that's what's great about the source we're using. He has this amazing ability to take these, frankly, very complex mathematical ideas and distill them, make them accessible.
Right. He bridges that gap between, you know, the hardcore math needed to actually build a neural network and the bigger picture, this sort of philosophical shift that these things represent.
Precisely. He helps us understand the why and the how conceptually.
Okay, so let's unpack that shift from programming the old way to learning the ML way. Because this really is the paradigm change, isn't it?
It totally is. In traditional programming, you have data coming in, you have the algorithm, the rules written by a person, and out comes the result. Simple enough.
Human in charge of the rules.
Right. But machine learning flips that script. The programmer gives the system the data and often the desired answers, the outputs for that data.
Okay.
And the algorithm's job, it's to figure out the relationship between the input data and those outputs. It essentially learns the rules from the examples.
So the workflow changes. It becomes data plus the learning algorithm leads to the system creating a model, which is the rules, and then that model produces the output.
Exactly. The machine derives the rules.
And a lot of people, when they hear ML, they think, oh, it's about super fast computers or it's about incredibly clever algorithms.
Mm.
But L. Payton really emphasizes the data itself, doesn't he? Why is just having loads of data maybe even more crucial than the algorithm?
That's a really key insight. Data is the fuel. Absolutely essential. Many of the algorithms we use, things like artificial neural networks, they're actually quite old ideas, theoretically.
Right, they've been around for decades.
Decades. But they were kind of dormant, computationally speaking. They needed two things to really take off. One, much cheaper and faster processing power, which we got.
Moore's Law and all that.
Yeah. And two, the absolute explosion of big data. Suddenly, we had oceans of examples to feed these algorithms.
So it's the sheer volume of examples that lets the model tweak its internal settings, its parameters, enough times to actually find those really subtle, complex patterns?
Precisely. It needs thousands, maybe millions of examples of blurry faces, tilted faces, faces partly hidden, to actually learn the general concept of face.
Okay, that makes sense. And that leads us straight into the core challenge, right? It's not just about being accurate on the data the system trained on.
No, absolutely not. That's almost irrelevant in the real world.
The critical thing is generalization.
Mm-hmm.
Can the model take its learnings from the training data and apply them accurately to completely new data it's never seen before?
That's the million-dollar question. Can it recognize a face it wasn't trained on? Can it filter a spam email with completely new phrasing?
And the big enemy of generalization is this thing called overfitting.
Right. Overfitting happens when the model learns the training data too well. It doesn't just learn the underlying patterns. It starts memorizing the specific examples, including all the random noise and quirks in that particular data set.
I always find the student analogy helpful here. An overfitted model is like that student who just memorizes the answers to every single practice question.
Mm-hmm. Verbatim.
Yeah, including any typos or weird formatting on the practice sheet. But then, if you ask them the same concept phrased slightly differently on the real test,
they're lost. They haven't actually understood the underlying principle. They just memorized the noise.
Exactly. Whereas a model that generalizes well is like the student who actually gets the concept. They can apply it to new problems, new situations.
Whether it's a new angle on a face or, you know, a different type of spam email, it understands the essence, not just the surface details.
Okay, this seems like a good point to get into the conceptual map Alpaden lays out. He talks about these three fundamental ways machines learn, sometimes called the three tribes of ML.
Yeah, and this framework is super useful because it immediately tells you there's no single magic bullet ML algorithm. The right approach really depends on the problem you're trying to solve and, crucially, what your data looks like.
It all comes down to the data you have available.
Pretty much. Is it labeled, meaning you have the right answers? Is it unlabeled, just a big pile of data? Or is the learning process interactive, involving feedback?
Okay, let's start with tribe one. This is the one most people probably think of first. Supervised learning. The system basically has a teacher.
Right. This requires labeled data. Every piece of training data comes with the correct answer, the label.
And supervised learning tends to break down into two main kinds of tasks based on what that answer looks like.
Exactly. First, you have classification. This is where the output is a distinct category, like a predefined bucket.
So things like, is this email spam or not scam? Is this picture a cat or a dog? Or maybe in medicine, is this tumor malignant or benign? You get a clear category label.
Yep, a discrete output. The second type is regression. Here, the output isn't a category, but a continuous numerical value.
Like predicting the exact price of a house down to the dollar, or forecasting tomorrow's temperature in degrees Celsius, or the amount of rainfall.
Any prediction that results in a number on a scale. And for both classification and regression, you use powerful models like decision trees or, very famously, artificial neural networks, ANNs.
Okay, so that's learning with a teacher, with labeled data. What about tribe two, unsupervised learning, the explorer, you called it?
Yeah, the explorer. Here, you've got unlabeled data, just a massive amount of information, but with no correct answers provided beforehand.
So no teacher this time?
No teacher. The goal here isn't to predict a specific output, but to find the hidden structure, the inherent patterns within the data itself.
So you're not predicting, you're discovering, grouping things.
Exactly. The main task is often clustering. Imagine a streaming service with millions of users. They don't start out knowing user types. Unsupervised learning can automatically group users based on similar listening habits.
Ah, so it might discover clusters like late night jazz fans or morning news podcast listeners, just by looking at the raw listening data.
Precisely. It finds similarities you didn't even know to look for.
Yeah.
Another key task here is dimensionality reduction.
Okay. That sounds technical.
It sounds it, but the idea is pretty intuitive. It's about simplifying really complex data with maybe hundreds or thousands of features by reducing the number of variables, but without losing the crucial information.
Yeah.
It's like creating a really smart summary or compression of the data. Makes it easier to work with, easier to visualize.
Got it. Okay, teacher, supervised, explorer, unsupervised. That leaves tribe three, reinforcement learning. This one feels different, more dynamic.
It is very different. It's all about learning to act in an environment. It's defined by this constant feedback loop.
Right. You mentioned three key parts.
Yeah, you have the agent, that's the learner, maybe it's the algorithm controlling a robot arm or playing a game. Then there's the environment, the world the agent operates in, like the factory floor or the chessboard.
Okay, agent and environment.
The agent takes an action within that environment, maybe it moves the robot arm or makes a move in the game. And then crucially, it receives a reward signal from the environment.
A reward, like positive or negative feedback.
Exactly. Positive reward if the action was good, like getting closer to picking up an object or capturing a piece in chess. Negative reward or punishment if the action was bad, like dropping the object or losing a piece.
And the agent's goal isn't just one good action, it's more long term.
Yes. The ultimate goal is to learn an optimal policy, a strategy, basically, a way of choosing actions over time that maximizes the total cumulative reward it expects to get in the future.
This sounds like how AlphaGo learned to play Go. It wasn't explicitly programmed with Go strategies, right?
Not at all. AlphaGo played millions upon millions of games against itself. It took actions, moves, got rewards, winning or losing the game, and gradually refined its policy, its strategy, through trial and error on a massive scale.
And that learning process involves a fundamental trade-off you mentioned. Exploration versus...
exploitation.
Yeah, the exploration versus exploitation dilemma. It's central to reinforcement learning.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, the agent constantly has to decide. Should I exploit what I already know? Should I take the action that, based on past experience, seems most likely to give me a good reward right now?
Stick with what works.
Right. Or should I explore? Should I try a different, perhaps seemingly random or risky action, one I haven't tried much before?
Why would it do that?
Because that risky, unexplored action might lead to an even bigger reward in the long run. It might uncover a whole new, better strategy.
So it's like ordering your favorite dish at a restaurant exploitation versus trying the weird-sounding daily special exploration. Exactly. You risk a potentially bad meal, negative reward, for the chance of discovering a fantastic new dish, a much higher future reward. Finding the right balance between exploiting known good actions and exploring new possibilities is key to learning effectively.
Okay, those three tribes, supervised, unsupervised, reinforcement, give us a really solid map of the territory. Now, if we think about actually using these models in the real world, Alpaden points out a pretty significant tension, right?
Yeah.
This trade-off between how well a model performs and how much we understand it.
Absolutely. This is the crucial performance versus interpretability trade-off. It's often called the black box problem.
The black box, right. So some models, especially the really complex ones like deep neural networks,
they can achieve incredible performance, amazing accuracy on really tough tasks, but it's often incredibly difficult, sometimes impossible, to understand why they made a specific prediction or decision. Their internal workings are opaque, a black box.
Whereas simpler models, like maybe those decision trees you mentioned earlier,
much more transparent. A decision tree is essentially just a flow chart. You can literally trace the path from the input data to the final decision, step by step. You know exactly why it decided what it did.
So there's a real tension there. In areas like, say, medical diagnosis or loan applications,
yeah,
where the consequences of a mistake are huge.
Exactly. Do you go with the slightly less accurate but fully understandable model or the super accurate black box where you can't explain the reasoning if something goes wrong? That's a major challenge in deploying ML responsibly.
But even with that complexity, just understanding this basic framework, supervised, unsupervised, reinforcement, makes you, the listener, a much smarter digital citizen, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. Suddenly your Netflix recommendations or your Spotify playlists, they don't seem like magic anymore.
Right. You realize, okay, this is probably some kind of unsupervised clustering grouping me with similar users, maybe combined with some supervised prediction about what I personally might like next.
You start to see the mechanisms behind the curtain, the personalized news feeds, the targeted ads you see online. They're all products of these learning models running constantly.
And being aware of that goes beyond just understanding recommendations, right? It touches on ethics.
Hugely important. Alpaden is very clear on this. ML models are probabilistic. They deal in likelihoods, not certainties.
They don't say, this is a cat.
No. They say, based on the data, there's a 98% probability this is a cat. That uncertainty is fundamental.
And that probabilistic nature, combined with the fact that they learn from historical data.
Yeah.
That's where bias creeps in.
Yes, this is the critical issue of algorithmic bias. If the data you feed the model reflects existing human biases, like, say, discriminatory hiring practices from the past,
the model doesn't know it's bias. It just sees a pattern in the data.
Exactly. It learns the bias as if it were a genuine pattern. And worse, it can then amplify that bias in its future predictions or decisions.
So if a model learns from bias loan application data that a certain group was historically denied loans more often, it might perpetuate or even worsen that discrimination in its own loan recommendations.
Precisely. It creates this dangerous feedback loop. Biased data leads to biased predictions, which can influence real-world outcomes, generating more biased data to train on next time. Understanding this is absolutely vital if we want to build fair systems.
Okay, so bringing this all together, what's the big takeaway from this deep dive into Alpaden's framework?
For me, the most striking thing is how these concepts, supervised, unsupervised, reinforcement learning, they feel like more than just technical categories. They feel like fundamental ways any intelligent system learns. Learning from examples with answers, learning by finding patterns in raw stuff, and learning through trial and error by interacting with the world.
I agree completely. That's the real power of this conceptual map. And the idea of generalization, being able to apply what you've learned to new situations, that's the hallmark of true learning. Whether you're talking about a machine or a person, it's the difference between memorizing and understanding.
Exactly. And Alpaden really argues that because these systems are becoming so powerful and so embedded in our lives, understanding them isn't just for computer scientists anymore. It's becoming a kind of civic imperative.
A responsibility for all of us.
Yeah. Which leads to maybe the final thought we should leave people with, building on Alpaden's point.
Go for it.
Given how powerful deep learning models are and how opaque they can sometimes be, that black box problem again, the real question for all of us as citizens, as consumers, is how do we make sure this incredibly powerful technology is guided responsibly?
How do we actively work to counteract the biases it might inherit from our own past and ensure it's used fairly?
That's the challenge. It requires awareness, critical thinking, and ongoing conversation. Alpaden's work gives us the foundational understanding we need to even start asking those crucial questions.
A fantastic conceptual map indeed. If you want to get beyond the buzzwords and really grasp the core ideas driving so much of our modern world, his work is an excellent place to start. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.